Today's program is brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Ben Mims, Mr. Sweet and Southern himself. Thank you for being here.
Of course, thank you for having me.
A couple quick announcements. One, we were both kind of like grooving to the music, to the theme song, and I always forget to mention how much I love that song and that band, Cookies.
It's pretty amazing.
And appropriately named Cookies for today, since we're going to be talking about baking and sweets. But I think they're touring right now, and you should definitely check out Cookies, the band. I think it's cookiesltd.com, and go see them live and in concert.
Definitely.
Number two, we will get to Valentine's Day in a little, but I abhor that holiday so much. And this in no way, I mean, it was part coincidence that you were available and that we're going to be talking about the sweeter things in life.
Yeah.
But don't think of this as a Valentine's Day episode. Absolutely please, not. Please, please. Yeah. I hope you have sweet things in your life all year round.
Exactly.
But first of all, you're going to help us pronounce something.
Okay.
There's this bridge over the Newton Creek here in Brooklyn attaching to Queens, but it's also the name of your hometown in Mississippi.
Yes.
How do we say this?
In Mississippi, we say Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko.
I'm not sure how they say it here, which I'm sure they would retain the Polish pronunciation.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Polish town name down in Mississippi. That's an odd one.
I think the general or whatever he was, he got around a lot, and so he founded lots of places, and so he just marked his name on that one.
Met a lot of women.
Yeah, met a lot of Native American women.
Yeah.
Yes, in the South.
The other thing I know about your town, other than it has a bridge associated with it, is I believe Oprah was born there.
She was born there, yeah.
Yeah. Is there like an Oprah Day? Is there fanfare?
There's not an Oprah Day. There is an Oprah. There's a house she grew up in, and the church that she went to, which are like conveniently located across the street from each other. And that street is conveniently by itself, just a dirt road path on the edge of town. And so that is Oprah Winfrey Lane as well.
Yeah.
And I think she gave us a Boys and Girls Club years ago, back when I was probably like 10 years ago. No Oprah Winfrey Day yet.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll be the next.
Yeah. I'm surprised there wasn't an Oprah Winfrey cake in this book.
There should be.
Maybe for the...
I'm sure she has some kind of special favorite cake that should be deemed that.
Yeah.
Renamed.
We're gonna work on that. I'm gonna
that's a good idea.
Expect that in the sequel. You were surrounded by, almost like Oprah, this form of entertainment. Mm-hmm. These lovely women who were fantastic bakers from your mother and your aunt. Not your grandma? Your grandma's neighbor?
No, my grandmother, she was a fantastic baker too, but she did not make the cakes that I kind of grew to love up. That was her neighbor across the street, who was one of those kind of quintessential cake ladies who, you know, literally in her old age, she would make layer cakes and, you know, sell them to community organizations for fundraisers, or, you know, take them to church potlucks, or, you know, just sell them to her neighbors across the street who wanted a cake but didn't have to go through, you know, the arduous task of making a layer cake, which is, you know, can be kind of time consuming.
And this is a coconut layer cake at that.
She did coconut and she did a caramel cake.
Yeah.
She may have made others, but those are the only two we ever had. So
from her, but
from
you
her.
Had a lot of cake
from
you.
From her, yeah, exactly.
Tell me about your mother's weekly pecan pie. And it's pecan, right?
Not pecan. Pie. Yeah, not pecan. Yeah. Pecan. She made, I think it was because she and I had a huge sweet tooth. My dad and my brother like loved salt, hated sweet. So we would always have something sweet around the house for, you know, after church, after our big lunch. And so I remember every weekend would get started off with either her making her pecan pie, which I put in the book because it was something, it was one of those recipes like the whole town like went nuts over. Everyone ever had it, they were like, oh my God, you have to have Judy's pecan pie. And so it was like a famous town recipe. And then it was either a pecan pie or she would do a cream cheese pound cake, which I remember very fondly, which was mostly cream cheese and just butter. And very dense, very rich. We would often like, you know, take slices of that, put it on a paper plate, add large, you know, like blocks of butter to it, you know, spaced around, and then microwave it until it was like hot and like extra butter. That was fantastic.
This is how they bulk up the football players down exactly. in Mississippi.
There's a reason why I weighed 60 pounds heavier yeah. than I do now. Like, I eat this all the time. And so she always had things like that going around. And, you know, after school, you know, an after school snack for me was always to make up a batch of tea cakes, which were these very cakey, you know, basic vanilla oil cookies that you could just stir up in a like a muffin batter pretty much and then just drop on a pan. They were done in 10 minutes. And so that was always, you know, an after school snack for me was to make those. So things like that, that we always just had around because, you know, it was just natural and we wanted them.
It's funny. I've been thinking about, you know, the kitchen of your childhood, probably at a very conventional oven. And now you work in Food and Wine's test kitchens.
Absolutely,
do you
yeah.
have convection ovens there?
We do have, we have ovens that can be, you know, switched on to do convection, but because we're still testing recipes that mostly people at home are going to use. And I think nowadays most people probably do have convection, you know, uses in their oven, or they can make convection, but it's still by and large a kind of foreign thing to most people. So we still use like regular conventional oven,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, how to say it, non-convection. But yeah, so it was,
it's like baking is such historical ingrained thing in the Americas that I just can't, sometimes it's hard to like put new equipment in the kitchen and
yeah.
expedite something that shouldn't be.
Exactly. And it's interesting because, like, you know, working, you know, I worked in California as a pastry chef for a while. Like, that's when I really, you know, used convection ovens a lot, and they are good for certain things, you know, because you get really, you know, the heat is swirled around them. There's, you know, a lot of a boost of air goes into whatever you're baking, so it gets a better rise out of whatever you're making. But some things it didn't necessarily work for, but some it is good for. And yeah, it's kind of fascinating to me to think about, you know, a lot of the cakes that I write about and or cookies were made or invented, you know, during the slave years in the South, when, you know, all you have is like a wood burning oven, and they had to make cakes in that. And so it was interesting to see, you know, the progression of, you know, looking at all those like old recipes that you find from like books back in the 1800s and things like that. You know, they would just say, you know, throw like, you know, a coconut cake into a hot oven, and that's just all they would ever call it. And so you kind of had to surmise, and then throughout the years kind of figure out what that was, and then it became 350 or a medium oven or things like that. And so it's interesting how the oven has changed what, you know, people bake and how we, you know, write recipes as they are
today. I feel like this intrigue came from your years at Savour. You spent 5 years there as a food editor,
yeah.
and, you know, the in-depthness of
yeah.
Researching
single
everything. Subject. Yeah.
Yeah. Researching everything to death. And that was kind of, you know, it definitely influenced the book and some of the recipes I put into the book, because the years there I spent baking, you know, because I was the one working in the test kitchen who was comfortable with baking, that's I kind of started just testing all the baking recipes that we would get in. And so through that, you know, whenever we needed a recipe for a carrot cake or a pavlova or something like that, it was my job to read through all the, you know, the library of cookbooks that we had, research every single recipe ever made for them, historical to modern, and figure out like what is a classic, you know, carrot cake or pavlova, and like what are the actual ingredients, you know, what are the variations that people have done, but by and large, what's like the most classic thing. And so I got to read and learn about, you know, a whole, you know, host of desserts or baked goods or whatever it would be, dishes that normally I wouldn't have. And I, yeah, kind of learned this kind of nerdy research-ness that I needed to have to really learn where something came from.
Yeah.
And I felt like that helped, you know, it helped kind of inform some of the recipes I put in the book too, because, you know, like a good class of the recipes I have in the book are ones that kind of merge the international recipes that I love with Southern. And I think that I could have only made those connections and, you know, seen those similarities through researching, you know, recipes from around the world, but also Southern recipes as well, and seeing where, you know, a cake or, you know, a dessert in Mexico has the same flavors, but it's just taking the different form as a pumpkin pie in, you know, the South, or a sweet potato pie in the South, excuse me. And so things like that. And so just trying to figure out where the similarities came from. And so then whenever I would, you know, have that dish again, I could be like, oh, this is such an easy, it's such an apparent, you know, similarity to what we have growing up in the South. And it's such a, not, you know, it's not just like a one-off update or one-off like random flavor thrown in. It has like, there's a reason why I'm, you know, making a sweet potato pie that has like ginger and orange in it.
Yeah.
Because it's flavored, because it's like the camotes, which is the Mexican sweet where they stew, you know, sweet potatoes and pumpkins in piloncillo, which is their kind of version of our brown sugar, with orange juice and ginger and cinnamon. And so, you know, in Mexico eating that, I was like, this tastes just like sweet potato pie back home, but, you know, with orange and ginger, which are not kind of usual things. And so I easily thought, you know, this, you know, pureed on its own and made into a custard is kind of like a cool version on a sweet potato pie. It's not groundbreaking, but it kind of links, you know, a Southern dessert to a Mexican one and through similar flavors, similar ingredients, or in a similar form.
So. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I kind of read through the book and separated it in my head in three mm-hmm, sections. Mm-hmm. And it really was that classic, mm-hmm. Variations of the classic,
yeah.
and then that global influence.
Yeah,
and definitely. You can see how those things build, but you have such a basics in the classics themselves that obviously that's how you can compare.
Yeah.
And one of the most interesting ones, I'm like, oh, this is truly a like old school Southern dessert.
Mm-hmm.
Which wasn't, is hummingbird cake.
Yeah, yeah. It's very...
1978.
Yeah. In the realm of, you know, or when you think about a timeline of like when foods are invented, that's a very young one. That was one that was invented by, I cannot remember the lady's name, but it was invented...
This is L.H. Wiggins.
Oh, you got it. There you go.
Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yes, and she submitted it to Southern Living in 1978, and it was her recipe. And it was, you know, for all intents and purposes... basically a really moist banana bread that had coconut and pineapple in it, and then layered with cream cheese frosting with pecans on the outside. And that was one that, you know, in the book I had recipes that were riffs on classics, but also ones that were just straight up classics. And I tried not to mess with them too much because they were just so amazing on their own. Like they didn't need to be messed with really much or updated. And that was one of the ones that on its own already, it was already, you know, it fit my parameters for being, you know, a natural thing. It was not too crazy sweet or, you know, or bland or just too rich. It was like the perfect dessert and kind of quintessential Southern dessert, even though it's very recent in the history. And so I wanted to take recipes like that and just leave them alone in a way, mm-hmm. and like maybe tone down the sugar a little bit and maybe kind of balance out the flavors with a little more salt or a little more lemon juice, things I always like to do, or less vanilla or things like that. And that was one of the recipes I kept as it was, but like for the sweet potato, you know, the camotes pie, I was thinking to myself, all right, sweet potato is such a classic, you know, pie in the American South, but who really needs another recipe? I mean, the way it's made already is mm-hmm. pretty classic and natural. And so that's why I wanted to riff on that. So some recipes where I thought, you know, just as they are is so amazing already, they don't need to be messed with. And some were just as amazing, but you know, people needed something else, something not as...
Well, what did your mother say when you made homemade corn syrup for her pecan pie?
She did not think it would actually work, probably. She was like, I know you can make corn syrup. And yeah. I was like, well, it's not technically corn syrup, but when you use corn syrup, if you don't even think about what the chemical reactions are in it, it's basically just a really thick, simple syrup. And so I knew from reading, you know... Harold McGee over the years and different things about how to make, how sugar crystallizes and things like that. I knew that if I made a really thick, simple syrup and added some lemon juice to it, both to balance the obvious sweetness of, you know, a ton of sugar in the syrup, but also it helps keep it, from crystallizing. And I think I'm probably getting this wrong, but, makes it kind of like an inverse syrup. It does something to the chemical properties in the sugar
an
to make
isomalt.
It. There you go. Yep. Yeah. To keep it liquid all the time.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I can do this.
Sublimation.
And this is the same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you're still using an intense amount of sugar, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's not high fructose corn syrup. It's not this crazy odd thing that a lot of people have a stigma attached to it these days. And so, yeah, she didn't believe it could actually even be made, but I was like, it can be, it's here. And so, but you know, in the book also, I've always been one to, I want to take the natural approach. I want to, you know, if you have a little more time, you know, make that corn syrup to make the thing better. But you know what? At the end of the day, I want you just to make the damn pie. Like
yeah.
if you're gonna, if you have to use Carol corn syrup, that's totally fine. I will not judge you whatsoever. I think a lot of people might judge you, but I won't. And I think that maybe judging about ingredients like that, where you think, oh God, if I don't have this, I can't make it. That takes the fun out of baking. And I want people to have fun. Like I want it to be a relaxed thing that there, you know, there's no stigma attached to using, you know, read ingredients if you don't want to. But if you have the time, make it all natural, make it the way I write it in the book, and it'll taste that much better. But definitely don't be like, I can't try this at all because I don't, you know, I can't make my own corn syrup right now.
I mean, so. What would you have said if it came to Christmas time and your Aunt Barbara Jane did not deliver one of her tins filled with all these great candies and cookies? What's in there? Oatmeal crisps?
Oatmeal crisps, which are basically like oatmeal raisin cookies, but without the raisins. And they're kind of more lacy. More fat, less, or more fat, less flour. And so they're like really crispy, crunchy, a lot more sugar. Those and her version of Mexican wedding cookies, which she called cocoons, which I found out a lot of people do that as well. And they're basically just, you know, the really, crunchy kind of walnut or pecan shortbread. She would use pecans rolled in powdered sugar. She would also make these, peanut and pretzel chocolate candies. They're basically like what I call like a redneck Rocher kind of thing. It's just literally peanuts and salty pretzels mixed with, she would use dark chocolate, like almond bark, the fake stuff. And so I was like, we need to use real chocolate for this. And then she would also make some good old southern sausage balls that a lot of people, some people know about, some people don't. I didn't include it in the book because it wasn't
sausage
sweet.
Sausage balls?
It's literally a box of Bisquick mix with a pound of browned spicy Italian sausage. And then I think a whole bag of like shredded Kraft cheddar cheese. You just mix it all up, form it to a ball, and bake it, and it is the best thing you've ever had.
See, that's what I want for Valentine's Day. I don't want these, you know, like little cakes and conversation hearts. Mm-hmm, I want one of these. What are they called?
Sausage balls.
Sausage balls.
And you would keep them in the tin. They would just get better as the days went on. You'd pop them in the microwave to heat them up. It was ridiculously trashy, but like the most amazing bite ever. And that was breakfast.
I want to get back to these updates because another one you did, you know, I don't know if your grandma's neighbor knows that you've changed her coconut cake a little bit.
Well, the coconut cake is actually, that one is not hers because, and the reason why is because I remember when I would be sitting around eating that cake, my mother would always say, you know, this is a fantastic coconut cake. I love it, but it's nothing compared to what my mom would make. Which is her mother, who is my grandmother, who actually died before I was born, so I never knew her. And so I was like, well, then prove it. Like, where is this woman's recipe? I need to make it then. And so the first time I ever made her recipe, I was kind of like flabbergasted because I'd never had a coconut cake that tasted that good because it was made unlike any other because it used only fresh coconut. There was no coconut extract. There was no, you know, cream of coconut. There was no sweetened shredded coconut from a bag either. It was literally just a plain buttermilk cake soaked in so much of the coconut water that it was almost like tres leches a little bit. And then you would stack it with an Italian meringue or like a 7-minute icing is what we called it. And like fresh grated coconut in your food processor. And that on its own, like when you stick it in the fridge, the 7-minute icing would kind of like turn into like a marshmallow, but then the super moist cake and you would eat a slice of that like cold from the fridge. And it was literally like drinking a glass of like cold coconut water or milk or something like that. It was like the most refreshing thing ever. Wasn't heavy. Didn't taste like, you know, super sweet or like, you know, just leaden with other stuff. It was like the most perfect cake ever. And so that's why I included that one in the book. But then my paternal grandmother's neighbor, who you're talking about, her caramel cake though, that's the one that made it in the book. Cause that one was such a fantastic cake. And that was an interesting cake to make whenever I, went over to her house and like made it with her because I wanted to include it in the book. And in what she always made it in a cast iron skillet, like the frosting. So the caramel frosting for these cakes is notoriously tricky. Like I made it before my own, like 1 out of 10 times it would work out because you're basically boiling all these ingredients to make this like caramelized milk fudge that will crystallize, you know, immediately if you don't work with it, or if you stir it too much. And then once it comes off the heat, you basically have like a couple minutes, maybe even not even that, to get it onto the cake. So it has to still be spreadable, but not too spreadable so that you can actually spread it without it running everywhere.
So it's not like Dobos Torte where you just like pour it on top of
the No, not at all. I wish it was like that. But this is like you pour it on there and you have to kind of spread it while it's still warm enough to spread. But within 30 seconds of it hitting the cold cake or even the room temperature cake, you know, and your room temperature and or cold, your knife or spatula, whatever you can spread it with, it will like start to seize up and become fudge immediately. So you're basically encasing a cake in hard fudge. So you kind of have to work with it while it's still warm. And that's like the trickiest thing. And so she would make it all on in a cast iron skillet on her stove. And because she had been making these cakes and this frosting for decades at this point, she didn't need a candy thermometer. She didn't need anything. She knew exactly what it would look like when it was starting to boil. My favorite thing was that she mixed in a whole egg into her icing from the get-go, which I was like, is that not going to curdle and yeah. boil up? And she's like, no, it's just there for texture. I'm like, that's nuts, but it works. Like, every time I make it, I'm like, I'm going to have little floating bits of egg in there. It never does. It's always, you know, seamless. But so, yeah, she could just, you know, swirl it with her wrist and then somehow, like, pick the skillet up, pour it over each layer, ice it, keep going, like, lickety-split, and she would have it perfectly every time. I was like, I've got to do this. And so when it came time for the book, I myself made the caramel cake to, like, perfect the frosting recipe, I think at least 8 or 9 times. And it was one of those things where I tell people in the book, you know, to be really good at this type of frosting recipe, you're going to have to just make the cake over and over again. You're going to have to fail lots of times. It has to become just kind of like a motion that you get used to, your body gets used to really know when to do it. But I tried my best to kind of like take some insurance out on making the frosting. So like, you know, if you use a cast iron either skillet or I call it like a enamelware cast iron pot like Creuset or a copper pot, because those pots retain heat longer, so that'll at least give you a little more time to keep your frosting kind of loose while you're still icing it and it's, you know, stuck in the pan. And I kind of warn people, I'm like, this is probably not gonna work the first time you make it. Just try it. And if you use these precautions, if you work with it, you know, if you do it, make it exactly how I say and beat it for this long and try to get it on there quickly and spread it like within 30 seconds, you should be fine. I still get nervous making it. Like, I'm not going to lie. It's just one of those things like, oh my God, this could go awfully wrong.
Well, I think this is one of those cakes that is better to go to the heart of Mississippi and
exactly
stop by your grandmother Carol's neighbor's house.
Which is why she was a cake lady. Like, you know, not many people can make this cake. And so she made it her profession. She got good at it. And that's why people bought it, because it was kind of a tricky thing. But it's so good. I think it's totally worth the effort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that cake a little bit more, the Deep South, but also a little about Sicily and Greece via Astoria, Queens. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, 5 generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here again with Ben Mims of Sweet and Southern.
Yes.
What is the subtitle of this cookbook again?
It's Classic Desserts with a Twist.
And that's what it is.
And that's exactly what
it is. I love when a book actually, you know, is exactly what it means to be.
Exactly. No, you know, I'm not, no smoke and mirrors. Like, this is what it is.
You're going to get your peach cobbler. You're going to get your peanut butter pie, your buttered pecan ice cream, cornbread pudding, which sounds fantastic, too. But it's these little riffs, these iterations that you were talking about, which just blow my mind a little bit. You get a bumper crop of cantaloupe every summer, and you're combining that with one of my favorite cake methods, the upside down.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was one where, you know, I love pineapple upside down cake, but again, that was one of those where it's already good as it is. How can you really improve upon it? And I wanted to do something like you. Like, I get all these cantaloupe. I love them, but like, what do you do with them? Like, you have to eat them raw. That's really it. Like, you can juice them, but that's kind of like gross water. You know, you don't really want to drink that. And you can make sorbet, yeah, but who really even likes sorbet that much? And so I kind of was like, there has to be some, you know, way I can use slices of cantaloupe that doesn't totally ruin the texture of the fruit, doesn't take away from the, like, the amazing flavor that it already has or overwhelm it. And so I figured, upside down cake would be the best, you know, just a plain kind of simple butter cake, not too much brown sugar in the topping, and, you know, kind of keep the vanilla and keep everything kind of low on, so you can kind of, the very faint flavor of the cantaloupe can shine through. And so it worked. And it kind of pairs perfectly with it because the cantaloupe is just so faintly sweet. And so when you have like a kind of a rich, buttery cake to go with it, you kind of don't need any other, you know, dressings on it. It's perfect as it is.
Yeah. The red velvet cake you didn't think was perfect as it had been.
Yeah.
And put a little pomegranate juice in there.
Yeah. It was, you know, I love red velvet cake. It's fine. But after a while, I don't have a huge problem with red food dye. But, you know, you don't really want to eat that stuff either all the time if you're just trying to not be unhealthy all the time. And so that was actually my editor of the book. He was allergic to red food dye. And he was like, I would love to have red velvet cake, but I haven't had it in years because I'm allergic to it. He said, can you find another way to make it? And I was like, okay. And so I knew that, you know, you can use beet juice to dye it the color that you want it to be, but I personally hate the flavor of beets in sweet things.
Yeah.
I like them on their own, but not, I don't like them that way. And I was like, well, there has to be some other way to make it this red color. And I, even though I knew that, you know, any kind of like red dyed liquid or juice or whatever probably wouldn't make it as dark of red as food coloring would, obviously, I still wanted to try it out. And so I kind of naively took pomegranate juice because that was the most closest thing I could think of. Tried to like reduce it down a little bit and mix it into the cake and see what came out. Unfortunately, it came out this like awful like maroon color. It was not beautiful whatsoever. But the pomegranate juice, because it has that kind of berry-ish tartness to it, played off the cocoa powder in the cake, played off the buttermilk, and kind of, it didn't make it more tangy, but it just kind of gave an extra kind of tang to it with you know, the pomegranate's own way it tastes. And so even though it doesn't look like a traditional red velvet, it's an interesting taste that I love that I think, you know, kind of updates it and makes it even tastier. And I tell people, you know, if you really just have to have blood red velvet cake, you can add the food dye, but it's not necessary.
Yeah.
So
I also like how you took what is an oceanic dessert, the pavlova, and put ambrosia on it. And it rhymes.
Yeah. Well, and we also joked while I was making the book, that would be my new drag name.
Yeah.
If I ever took up that profession.
Yeah.
But no, that was another kind of natural, you know, similarity that I saw. Like, you know, pavlova is one of my favorite desserts ever. I love meringue, you know, probably more than any other thing in the entire world. I think it's the most amazing textural, you know, sweet, crunchy dessert ever. And, you know, top it with some whipped cream, some grapefruit, and a lemon curd. Like, you can't really beat that. Like, that is the ultimate dessert to me. And growing up, we always had ambrosia salad, which, if you're from the South, you know, it's this, like, jello mold type salad of, like, coconut, oranges, maraschino cherries. Sometimes there'd be marshmallows thrown in for good measure. I had versions that were like lime jello and pistachio, which was exotic for back then. Always marshmallows. And so I was like, here's this like fluffy, sometimes crunchy, kind of tropical, you know, amalgam of junk that we love to eat as like a salad, quote unquote, in the South. And, you know, I was like, these flavors and this whole texture and the way you eat it translates perfectly to a pavlova. I mean, it's, you still have the same like cool, you know, creamy whipped cream, the crunchy meringue, and then you just add on the coconut. I think I added grapefruit and oranges in the recipe with lime and just keep that tropical vibe going, like real cherries. I made a pineapple curd for it because who needs another recipe for lemon curd? And I feel like pineapple is more exciting fruit for me. I love it more. And so it just made sense. You know, it was just like a way to still have ambrosia salad, but not using jello or not using like maraschino cherries and not using some kind of weird ingredients. And so it was probably one of my favorite desserts in the whole book.
One of the most intriguing for me, because I've been to Sicily, is the cassata.
Oh, yeah.
Which, I'm not knocking Sicilian desserts, but there's a point where you're like, I don't want any more ricotta.
Exactly.
In all its, you know, crazy forms, from ferme to sale to whip to this.
Yeah.
And I do love a cassata, but, you know, you're scared of, you know, how dense and how heavy it might be. And this is where you praise the power of cream cheese.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and cream cheese per se is not really a Southern ingredient, but I feel like because of its association with, you know, the icing, like on red velvet cake, it's on hummingbird cake. I feel like people, when they think of the South, they think, oh, we put cream cheese on everything. And so I kind of, you know, ordain it. Not officially, kind of a Southern cheese. And they do make Creole cream cheese in New Orleans, which is one of my favorites.
I don't even know what that is.
I think it's like a fresh version of cream cheese that they make. I don't know how they make it, but it basically is like cream cheese, but like much smoother. And you can get it down there and it kind of acts in the same way. And I love it. And so for the cassata, that was one where I'd worked on, you know, developing like the most classic, amazing, perfect cassata that had ever been invented for Savour. And, you know, while researching, I saw where most people in Sicily use like almond paste for the marzipan, but they would like dye it green to look like pistachio. Some people did use pistachio, but not a lot. And it was like a simple sponge cake mixed with, you know, just sweetened ricotta, like a cannoli filling kind of thing. And then topped with, you know, a simple glaze and those mammoth like candied fruits like citron and orange and day glow cherries. And so I thought to myself, I love this thing so much. This is an easy way that I can kind of swap out ingredients and make it kind of a Southern thing. Southerners love very elaborate desserts. They love elaborate things, period. And so it kind of made sense. And so I just on a whim thought I can make marzipan out of pecans. Don't know if anybody's ever done it before. We're going to try it. It worked perfectly because with nuts, you can kind of swap them in and out pretty easily. And then I kept the cake pretty simple, used cream cheese, lightened it up a bit, for the actual filling. And then I think I used some bourbon in the syrup to soak the cake.
You think
instead
you
of
used
rum.
Some bourbon? I don't remember.
No, I definitely used bourbon.
Yeah.
But that was my reasoning for doing it was because I wanted to make the Southern cassata. And so I used, I think was because I used like a couple of tablespoons. Yeah. I should have used probably more than that, but to make it really boozy. Used bourbon. And then with the glaze on top, I used kind of what I consider quintessential Southern ingredients. I used pecans. Coconut, which is not, but it kind of is through use of the cake and everything, and the sweetened shredded stuff, which a lot of people use, and then bananas, all these flavors that to me, yeah, they're tropical, but they're also kind of Southern in a way because they are used so much in so many Southern dishes, and it kind of worked. It translated perfectly, and I was like, here's this dessert that's not new at all, but it's a different guise for Southerners, and, people who are Sicilian or know of a cassata will be like, wow, that's interesting as well. So it kind of worked perfectly for that.
I'm interested to try that one. It's really good. You know, what's even a step further, there's like one you did a double translation to, the Indonesian inspired.
Oh yeah.
The
spekhoek.
Yeah. Which is originally based off of Dutch baking traditions.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
Tell me about this long lineage of dessert.
Yeah. That was a dessert that, when I first got to Savour, James Oslin, my editor-in-chief there, he had written books on, or a book on called Creative Flavor on Indonesian Malaysian cooking. And so he only had, I think, maybe like three desserts in the whole book. And that was one of them. And I remember him telling me whenever I was in the kitchen and making all the sweets all the time, he's like, you have to make this cake. It's amazing. And it was basically a extremely butter laden Dutch cake that had a ton of cinnamon in it as well. And they would, in the tradition of the Dutch, I think they call it like a tree cake. I don't know what the actual name of it is, but they would have a rod like a rotisserie over a fire and paint on cake batter as the rod is going around and around. And then eventually as the cake kind of sets on the bottom and rolls forward.
It's like Baumkuchens.
Baumkuchen. There you go. And so you get these like rings of
I don't even know that because
cake batter.
My wife's last name is.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. But it's the same thing. And so you get these like layers, tree rings of cake after a while, like caramelized, super rich butter cake, with like the moist inside. And so they did that, but they did it in a pan and you just like keep baking layers until you had this striated effect of like really caramelized cake mixed with the plain, batter on the inside. And so I knew I wanted to, that was one of my favorite cakes I ever made once I actually made it. And I was like, I have to kind of riff on this as well. And so that was a very simple twist on that one. I kind of wanted to make it slightly different to me with the caramel notes that you get from the caramelized cake after each layer. I added some chocolate to half the batter because I was like, that would be a really good kind of like caramel chocolate without being caramel really cake to do. And it kind of comes out perfectly because like once by the time you finish the very top layer and you have these striations of cake that kind of look like bacon fat rippled through a piece of bacon, the cake is set not unappealingly crunchy on the bottom. And so you can cut it into like kind of thin slices and it's almost like a cookie at that point, but also still tender enough to be a cake. And it's kind of surprising, like the texture you get, like I can't really describe it because it's so in between like a crispy cookie and a piece of cake.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What I want you to develop out of that, go even further and do the rotisserie style barbecue, during the summer.
Oh yeah.
Style of that cake. Imagine
absolutely,
making
a
cake over a fire at someone's, backyard
barbecue.
Absolutely.
And with, vanilla and chocolate layers, it would look like crazy marbled and everything. That'd be amazing.
I know I said this isn't a Valentine's Day show, but what is it? Saturday is Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Saturday mornings for you were fluffy biscuits and muscadine jelly.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, how amazing is that to wake up and have a relaxing weekend with those two things in hand? And also tell us, what the hell is muscadine?
Muscadines are a variety of southern grape, I believe, that kind of thrive in really hot weather. So they're always very sour, and they have like a really tough skin. I only know this because we had a tree in my grandmother's backyard, and we would go pick them and eat them, and they had a gigantic seed in the middle. So you got any flesh whatsoever. It was mostly really tough skin and seed. But what little juice you did get out of it, because it was so sour and kind of not very sweet, it kind of lent itself to making a jelly, and it was really high in pectin as well. So you could, you know, literally just cook down some of the berries or some of the muscadines, strain out the seeds and skin, and what you were left with was this, you know, very congealed gelatinous pulp that it had, and had great flavor. And you just add a little bit of sugar, and so it made this like kind of ruby tinted jelly, almost like Concord grape skins will, like, you know, color Concord grape jelly. It's the same way, because the skin of the muscadine is a little lighter purple, so it made this beautiful like kind of ruby jam. And so we always had that. That was made by a lady in our town locally. Don't remember her name, don't remember what she called it, but I remember, you know, the Mississippi logo being on the front of the ball jar. And yeah, it was like a very loose set jelly. And so I would wake up every Saturday morning. It was either pancakes or biscuits. Most of the time it was biscuits in a cast iron skillet, rise up puffy, not very crunchy on the bottom or the top. I think that's something when I've been talking to people about what I'm so fanatic about biscuits about, is that a lot of people, when they make biscuits, they get them really brown on the outside. And it's not supposed to be like a crunchy dinner roll. It's supposed to be a very fluffy, kind of like almost underbaked thing in the middle that you only have no more than 10 minutes out of the oven. Like, if it's not piping hot and kind of like burning you, then you've lost the effect of it, because then you're just eating a leaden piece of dough, you know? But we always had that, you know, you split them open, get the butter on it really quick, maybe close it for like a minute to let the butter melt, open it back up, throw the jelly on there and eat it while it's still hot. And it was, it's heaven. It's,
I only hope some people replace, you know, Valentine's red with the ruby red muscadine jelly and that a fluffy biscuit.
New tradition, yeah.
And if you're thinking about that, obviously the recipe is in Sweden Southern.
Definitely.
And even if you're not planning to bake this Valentine's Day, please plan to bake the rest of the year and get this book. Thank exactly. you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.